This book contains up to 4 sides per cassette. Side 1. The Stars, My Destination by Alfred Bester. Copyright 1956 by Alfred Bester. Narrated by Roy Avers. This book contains 235 pages on 6 sides. If you would like to skip over any remaining announcements or introductory material, place your cassette player and fast forward until a beep is heard. Stop at that point to hear the beginning of the book. Annotation. In a grotesque future where men have acquired the ability of instant teleportation, Gully Foyle, a common rogue, vows to track down the men who left him to die in a wrecked spaceship. In doing so, he becomes the pathfinder of man's destiny among the stars. From the book jacket. Meet Gully Foyle. In the select company of science fiction novels of greatness, the place of The Stars, My Destination is secure. In the company of truly unforgettable SF characters, Gully Foyle stands nearly alone, sailor among the stars, criminal and hero, poet and rogue. Utterly alone when first met, marooned in deep space, his chances of survival near zero, Gully has only begun his violent odyssey. Join Gully Foyle in the non-stop adventure classic that you won't want to end, and you won't ever forget. Gully Foyle, rogue, soldier of fortune, and above all, survivor. Lost in space aboard a doomed starship, he is impelled with the native wit of a blind beggar toward whatever life there may be left among the cold stars of the galaxy. Saved and back on Earth, he runs afoul of dangers more terrible than certain death in airless space. Caught between his own lethargy and the threats and intrigues surrounding him, Gully's only salvation lies in expanding his own puny powers to achieve Earth's miraculous new mode of transportation, instant transmission of one's body, the jaunt. About the author. Alfred Bester, author of just 3 science fiction novels, The Demolished Man, The Stars, My Destination, and The Computer Connection. The first 2 are acknowledged classics and long-term bestsellers. The third, The Computer Connection, published in 1975, 18 years after the first appearance of The Stars, My Destination, marked a major event in contemporary science fiction. The vitality, excitement, and non-stop pace of The Stars, My Destination set it apart from all other science fiction and make it unmistakably Alfred Bester's. Dedication. To Truman M. Talley. Part 1. Tiger, tiger, burning bright in the forests of the night, what immortal hand or eye could frame thy fearful symmetry? Blake. Prologue. This was a golden age, a time of high adventure, rich living and hard dying. But nobody thought so. This was a future of fortune and theft, pillage and rapine, culture and vice, but nobody admitted it. This was an age of extremes, a fascinating century of freaks, but nobody loved it. All the habitable worlds of the solar system were occupied. 3 planets and 8 satellites and 11 million people swarmed in one of the most exciting ages ever known, yet minds still yearned for other times, as always. The solar system seethed with activity, fighting, feeding, and breeding, learning the new technologies that spewed forth almost before the old had been mastered, girding itself for the first exploration of the far stars in deep space. But where are the new frontiers? The romantics cried, unaware that the frontier of the mind had opened in a laboratory on Callisto at the turn of the 24th century. A researcher named Jaunt set fire to his bench and himself, accidentally, and let out a yell for help with particular reference to a fire extinguisher. Who so surprised as Jaunt and his colleagues when he found himself standing alongside said extinguisher, 70 feet removed from his lab bench? They put Jaunt out and went into the whys and wherefores of his instantaneous 70-foot journey. Teleportation, the transportation of oneself through space by an effort of the mind alone, had long been a theoretic concept, and there were a few hundred badly documented proofs that it had happened in the past. This was the first time that it had ever taken place before professional observers. They investigated the jaunt effect savagely. This was something too earth-shaking to handle with kid gloves, and Jaunt was anxious to make his name immortal. He made his will and said farewell to his friends. Jaunt knew he was going to die because his fellow researchers were determined to kill him if necessary. There was no doubt about that. 12 psychologists, parapsychologists, and neurometrists of varying specialization were called in as observers. The experimenters sealed Jaunt into an unbreakable crystal tank. They opened a water valve, feeding water into the tank, and let Jaunt watch them smash the valve handle. It was impossible to open the tank. It was impossible to stop the flow of water. The theory was that if it had required the threat of death to goad Jaunt into teleporting himself in the first place, they'd damned well threaten him with death again. The tank filled quickly. The observers collected data with the tense precision of an Eclipse camera crew. Jaunt began to drown. Then he was outside the tank, dripping and coughing explosively. He'd teleported again. The experts examined and questioned him. They studied graphs and X-rays, neural patterns and body chemistry. They began to get an inkling of how Jaunt had teleported. On the technical grapevine, this had to be kept secret, they sent out a call for suicide volunteers. They were still in the primitive stage of teleportation. Death was the only spur they knew. They briefed the volunteers thoroughly. Jaunt lectured on what he had done and how he thought he had done it. Then they proceeded to murder the volunteers. They drowned them, hanged them, burned them. They invented new forms of slow and controlled death. There was never any doubt in any of the subjects that death was the object. 80% of the volunteers died, and the agonies and remorse of their murderers would make a fascinating and horrible study, but that has no place in this history, except to highlight the monstrosity of the times. 80% of the volunteers died, but 20% jaunted. The name became a word almost immediately. "Bring back the Romantic Age," the romantics pleaded, "when men could risk their lives in high adventure." The body of knowledge grew rapidly. By the first decade of the 24th century, the principles of jaunting were established, and the first school was opened by Charles Fort Jaunt himself, then 57, immortalized. And ashamed to admit that he had never dared jaunt again. But the primitive days were past. It was no longer necessary to threaten a man with death to make him teleport. They had learned how to teach man to recognize, discipline, and exploit yet another resource of his limitless mind. How exactly did man teleport? One of the most unsatisfactory explanations was provided by Spencer Thompson, publicity representative of the Jaunt Schools, in a press interview. Thompson: "Jaunting is like seeing. It is a natural aptitude of almost every human organism, but it can only be developed by training and experience." Reporter: "You mean we couldn't see without practice?" Thompson: "Obviously you're either unmarried or have no children. Preferably both." Laughter. Reporter: "I don't understand." Thompson: "Anyone who's observed an infant learning to use its eyes would." Reporter: "But what is teleportation?" Thompson: "The transportation of oneself from one locality to another by an effort of the mind alone." Reporter: "You mean we can think ourselves from, say, New York to Chicago?" Thompson: "Precisely, provided one thing is clearly understood. In jaunting from New York to Chicago, it is necessary for the person teleporting himself to know exactly where he is when he starts and where he's going." Reporter: "How's that?" Thompson: "If you were in a dark room and unaware of where you were, it would be impossible to jaunt anywhere with safety. And if you knew where you were, but intended to jaunt to a place you had never seen, you would never arrive alive. One cannot jaunt from an unknown departure point to an unknown destination. Both must be known, memorized, and visualized." Reporter: "But if we know where we are and where we're going..." Thompson: "We can be pretty sure we'll jaunt and arrive." Reporter: "Would we arrive naked?" Thompson: "If you started naked." Laughter. Reporter: "I mean, would our clothes teleport with us?" Thompson: "When people teleport, They also teleport the clothes they wear and whatever they are strong enough to carry. I hate to disappoint you, but even ladies' clothes would arrive with them. Laughter. Reporter. But how do we do it? Thompson. How do we think? Reporter. With our minds. Thompson. And how does the mind think? What is the thinking process? Exactly how do we remember, imagine, deduce, create? Exactly how do the brain cells operate? Reporter. I don't know. Nobody knows. Thompson. And nobody knows exactly how we teleport either, but we know we can do it, just as we know that we can think. Have you ever heard of Descartes? He said, cogito ergo sum. I think, therefore I am. We say, cogito ergo jauntio. I think, therefore I jaunt. If it is thought that Thompson's explanation is exasperating, inspect this report of Sir John Kelvin to the Royal Society on the mechanism of jaunting. We have established that the teleportative ability is associated with the Nissl bodies, or tigroid substance, in nerve cells. The tigroid substance is easiest demonstrated by Nissl's method using 3.75 grams of methylene blue and 1.75 grams of Venetian soap dissolved in 1,000 cc's of water. Where the tigroid substance does not appear, jaunting is impossible. Teleportation is a tigroid function. Applause. Any man was capable of jaunting, provided he developed two faculties, visualization and concentration. He had to visualize completely and precisely the spot to which he desired to teleport himself, and he had to concentrate the latent energy of his mind into a single thrust to get him there. Above all, he had to have faith. The faith that Charles Fort Jaunt never recovered. He had to believe he would jaunt. The slightest doubt would block the mind thrust necessary for teleportation. The limitations with which every man is born necessarily limited the ability to jaunt. Some could visualize magnificently and set the coordinates of their destination with precision, but lacked the power to get there. Others had the power, but could not, so to speak, see where they were jaunting. And space set a final limitation, for no man had ever jaunted further than 1,000 miles. He could work his way in jaunting jumps over land and water from Nome to Mexico, but no jump could exceed 1,000 miles. By the 2420s, this form of employment application blank had become a commonplace. This space reserved for retina pattern identification. Name, capital letters. Last, middle, first. Residence. Legal. Continent, country, county. Jaunt class, official rating, check one only. M, 1,000 miles. D, 500 miles. C, 100 miles. L, 50 miles. X, 10 miles. V, 5 miles. The old Bureau of Motor Vehicles took over the new job and regularly tested and classed jaunt applicants, and the old American Automobile Association changed its initials to AJA. Despite all efforts, no man had ever jaunted across the voids of space, although many experts and fools had tried. Helmut Grant, for one, who spent a month memorizing the coordinates of a jaunt stage on the moon, and visualized every mile of the 240,000-mile trajectory from Times Square to Kepler City. Grant jaunted and disappeared. They never found him. They never found Enzio Dandridge, a Los Angeles revivalist looking for heaven. Jakob Maria Freundlich, a paraphysicist who should have known better than to jaunt into deep space searching for metadimensions. Shipwreck Kogan, a professional seeker after notoriety, and hundreds of others, lunatic fringers, neurotics, escapists, and suicides. Space was closed to teleportation. Jaunting was restricted to the surfaces of the planets of the solar system. But within 3 generations, the entire solar system was on the jaunt. The transition was more spectacular than the changeover from horse and buggy to gasoline age 4 centuries before. On 3 planets and 8 satellites, social, legal, and economic structures crashed, while the new customs and laws demanded by universal jaunting mushroomed in their place. There were land riots, as the jaunting poor deserted slums to squat in plains and forests, raiding the livestock and wildlife. There was a revolution in home and office building. Labyrinths and masking devices had to be introduced to prevent unlawful entry by jaunting. There were crashes and panics and strikes and famines as pre-jaunt industries failed. Plagues and pandemics raged as jaunting vagrants carried disease and vermin into defenseless countries. Malaria, elephantiasis, and the breakbone fever came north to Greenland. Rabies returned to England after an absence of 300 years. The Japanese beetle, the citrus scale, the chestnut blight, and the elm borer spread to every corner of the world. And from one forgotten pest hole in Borneo, leprosy, long imagined extinct, reappeared. Crime waves swept the planets and satellites as their underworlds took to jaunting with a night around the clock, and there were brutalities as the police fought them without quarter. There came a hideous return to the worst prudery of Victorianism as society fought the sexual and moral dangers of jaunting with protocol and taboo. A cruel and vicious war broke out between the inner planets, Venus, Terra, and Mars, and the outer satellites, a war brought on by the economic and political pressures of teleportation. Until the jaunt age dawned, the three inner planets and the moon had lived in delicate economic balance with the seven inhabited outer satellites. Io, Europa, Ganymede, and Callisto of Jupiter, Rhea and Titan of Saturn, and Lassell of Neptune. The united outer satellites supplied raw materials for the inner planets' manufactories and a market for their finished goods. Within a decade, this balance was destroyed by jaunting. The outer satellites, raw young worlds in the making, had bought 70% of the IP transportation production. Jaunting ended that. They had bought 90% of the IP communications production. Jaunting ended that, too. In consequence, IP purchase of OS raw materials fell off. With trade exchange destroyed, it was inevitable that the economic war would degenerate into a shooting war. Inner planets' cartels refused to ship manufacturing equipment to the outer satellites, attempting to protect themselves against competition. The OS confiscated the planets already in operation on their worlds, broke patent agreements, ignored royalty obligations, and the war was on. It was an age of freaks, monsters, and grotesques. All the world was misshapen in marvelous and malevolent ways. The classicists and romantics who hated it were unaware of the potential greatness of the 25th century. They were blind to a cold fact of evolution, that progress stems from the clashing merger of antagonistic extremes, out of the marriage of pinnacle freaks. Classicists and romantics alike were unaware that the solar system was trembling on the verge of a human explosion that would transform man and make him the master of the universe. It is against this seething background of the 25th century that the vengeful history of Gulliver Foyle begins. Chapter 1. He was 170 days dying, and not yet dead. He fought for survival with the passion of a beast in a trap. He was delirious and rotting, but occasionally his primitive mind emerged from the burning nightmare of survival into something resembling sanity. Then he lifted his mute face to eternity and muttered, "What's the matter, me? Help, you goddamn gods! Help us all!" Blasphemy came easily to him. It was half his speech, all his life. He had been raised in the gutter school of the 25th century and spoke nothing but the gutter tongue. Of all brutes in the world, he was among the least valuable alive and most likely to survive. So he struggled and prayed in blasphemy, but occasionally his raveling mind leaped backward 30 years to his childhood and remembered a nursery jingle. "Gully Foyle is my name, and Terra is my nation. Deep space is my dwelling place, and death's my destination." He was Gulliver Foyle, mechanic's mate third class, 30 years old, big-boned and rough, and 170 days adrift in space. He was Gully Foyle the oiler, wiper, bunker man, too easy for trouble, too slow for fun, too empty for friendship, too lazy for love. The lethargic outlines of his character showed in the official Merchant Marine records. Foyle Gulliver, AS-128/127:006. Education, none. Skills, none. Merits, none. Recommendations, none. Personnel comments. A man of physical strength and intellectual potential, stunted by lack of ambition. Energizes at minimum. The stereotype common man. Some unexpected shock might possibly awaken him, but psych cannot find the key. Not recommended for promotion. Has reached a dead end. He had reached a dead end. He had been content to drift from moment to moment of existence for 30 years like some heavily armored creature, sluggish and indifferent. Gully foil, the stereotype common man. But now he was adrift in space for 170 days, and the key to his awakening was in the lock. Presently it would turn and open the door to Holocaust. The spaceship Nomad drifted halfway between Mars and Jupiter. Whatever war catastrophe had wrecked it had taken a sleek steel rocket 100 yards long and 100 feet broad and mangled it into a skeleton on which was mounted the remains of cabins, holds, decks, and bulkheads. Great rents in the hull were blazes of light on the sun side and frosty blotches of stars on the dark side. The SS Nomad was a weightless emptiness of blinding sun and jet shadow, frozen and silent. The wreck was filled with a floating conglomerate of frozen debris that hung within the destroyed vessel like an instantaneous photograph of an explosion. The minute gravitational attraction of the bits of rubble for each other was slowly drawing them into clusters, which were periodically torn apart by the passage through them of the one survivor still alive on the wreck, Gulliver Foyle, AS-128/127:006. He lived in the only airtight room left intact in the wreck, a tool locker off the main deck corridor. The locker was 4 feet wide, 4 feet deep, and 9 feet high. It was the size of a giant's coffin. 600 years before, it had been judged the most exquisite Oriental torture to imprison a man in a cage that size for a few weeks. Yet Foyle had existed in this lightless coffin for 5 months, 20 days, and 4 hours.
"Who are you?"
"Gully Foyle is my name."
"Where are you from?"
"Terra is my nation."
"Where are you now?"
"Deep space is my dwelling place."
"Where are you bound?"
"Death's my destination."
On the 171st day of his fight for survival, Foyle answered these questions and awoke. His heart hammered, and his throat burned. He groped in the dark for the air tank which shared his coffin with him and checked it. The tank was empty. Another would have to be moved in at once. So this day would commence with an extra skirmish with death, which Foyle accepted with mute endurance. He felt through the locker shelves and located a torn spacesuit. It was the only one aboard Nomad, and Foyle no longer remembered where or how he had found it. He had sealed the tear with emergency spray, but had no way of refilling or replacing the empty oxygen cartridges on the back. Foyle got into the suit. It would hold enough air from the locker to allow him 5 minutes in vacuum. No more. Foyle opened the locker door and plunged out into the black frost of space. The air in the locker puffed out with him, and its moisture congealed into a tiny snow cloud that drifted down the torn main deck corridor. Foyle heaved at the exhausted air tank, floated it out of the locker, and abandoned it. 1 minute was gone. He turned and propelled himself through the floating debris toward the hatch to the ballast hold. He did not run. His gait was the unique locomotion of free fall and weightlessness. Thrusts with foot, elbow, and hand against deck, wall, and corner. A slow motion darting through space, like a bat flying underwater. Foyle shot through the hatch into the dark side ballast hold. 2 minutes were gone. Like all spaceships, Nomad was ballasted and stiffened with a mass of her gas tanks laid down the length of her keel like a long lumber raft tapped at the sides by a labyrinth of pipe fittings. Foyle took a minute disconnecting an air tank. He had no way of knowing whether it was full or already exhausted, whether he would fight it back to his locker only to discover that it was empty and his life was ended. Once a week he endured this game of space roulette. There was a roaring in his ears. The air in his spacesuit was rapidly going foul. He yanked the massy cylinder toward the ballast hatch, ducked to let it sail over his head, then thrust himself after it. He swung the tank through the hatch. 4 minutes had elapsed, and he was shaking and blacking out. He guided the tank down the main deck corridor and bolted into the tool locker. He slammed the locker door, dogged it, found a hammer on a shelf, and swung it thrice against the frozen tank to loosen the valve. Foyle twisted the handle grimly. With the last of his strength, he unsealed the helmet of his spacesuit, lest he suffocate within the suit while the locker filled with air, if this tank contained air. He fainted, as he had fainted so often before, never knowing whether this was death.
"Who are you, Gully Foyle? Where are you from? Terra? Where are you now? Space? Where are you bound?"
He awoke. He was alive. He wasted no time on prayer or thanks, but continued the business of survival. In the darkness, he explored the locker shelves where he kept his rations. There were only a few packets left. Since he was already wearing the patched spacesuit, he might just as well run the gauntlet of vacuum again and replenish his supplies. He flooded his spacesuit with air from the tank, resealed his helmet, and sailed out into the frost and light again. He squirmed down the main deck corridor and ascended the remains of a stairway to the control deck, which was no more than a roofed corridor in space. Most of the walls were destroyed. With the sun on his right and the stars on his left, Foyle shot aft toward the galley storeroom. Halfway down the corridor, he passed a door frame still standing four square between deck and roof. The leaf still hung on its hinges, half open, a door to nowhere. Behind it was all space and the steady stars. As Foyle passed the door, he had a quick view of himself reflected in the polished chrome of the leaf. Gully Foyle, a giant black creature, bearded, crusted with dried blood and filth, emaciated with sick, patient eyes, and followed always by a stream of floating debris, the raffle disturbed by his motion and following him through space like the tail of a festering comet. Foyle turned into the galley storeroom and began looting with the methodical speed of 5 months' habit. Most of the bottled goods were frozen solid and exploded. Much of the canned goods had lost their containers, for tin crumbles to dust in the absolute zero of space. Foyle gathered up ration packets, concentrates, and a chunk of ice from the burst water tank. He threw everything into a large copper cauldron, turned, and darted out of the storeroom, carrying the cauldron. At the door to nowhere, Foyle glanced at himself again, reflected in the chrome leaf framed in the stars. Then he stopped his motion in bewilderment. He stared at the stars behind the door, which had become familiar friends after 5 months. There was an intruder among them, a comet, it seemed, with an invisible head and a short, spurting tail. Then Foyle realized he was staring at a spaceship, stern rockets flaring as it accelerated on a sunward course that must pass him.
"No," he muttered. "No, man, no."
He was continually suffering from hallucinations. He turned to resume the journey back to his coffin. Then he looked again. It was still a spaceship, stern rockets flaring as it accelerated on a sunward course which must pass him. He discussed the illusion with eternity.
6 months already, he said in his gutter tongue. Is it now? You listen to me, lousy gods. I talk in a deal is all. I look again, sweet prayer men. If it's a ship, I'm yours. You own me. But if it's a gaff, man, if it's no ship, I unseal right now and blow my guts. We both ballast level us. Now reach me the sign, yes or no is all.
He looked for a third time. For the third time, he saw a spaceship, stern rockets flaring, as it accelerated on a sunward course which must pass him. It was the sign. He believed he was saved. Foyle shoved off and went hurtling down control deck corridor toward the bridge. But at the companionway stairs, he restrained himself. He could not remain conscious for more than a few more moments without refilling his spacesuit. He gave the approaching spaceship one pleading look, then shot down to the tool locker and pumped his suit full. He mounted to the control bridge. Through the starboard observation port, he saw the spaceship, stern rockets still flaring, evidently making a major alteration in course, for it was bearing down on him very slowly. On a panel marked flares, Foyle pressed the distress button. There was a 3-second pause during which he suffered. Then white radiance blinded him as the distress signal went off in 3 triple bursts, 9 prayers for help. Foyle pressed the button twice again, and twice more the flares flashed in space while the radioactives incorporated in their combustion set up a static howl that must register on any wave band of any receiver. The stranger's jets cut off. He had been seen. He would be saved. He was reborn. He exulted. Foyle darted back to his locker and replenished his space suit again. He began to weep. He started to gather his possessions, a faceless clock which he kept wound just to listen to the ticking, a lug wrench with a hand-shaped handle which he would hold in lonely moments, an egg slicer upon whose wires he would pluck primitive tunes. He dropped them in his excitement, hunted for them in the dark, then began to laugh at himself. He filled his spacesuit with air once more and capered back to the bridge. He punched a flare button labeled Rescue. From the hull of the Nomad shot a sunlet that burst and hung, flooding miles of space with harsh white light.
Come on, baby, you, Foyle crooned. Hurry up, man. Come on, baby, baby, you.
Like a ghost torpedo, the stranger slid into the outermost rim of light, approaching slowly, looking him over. For a moment, Foyle's heart constricted. The ship was behaving so cautiously that he feared she was an enemy vessel from the outer satellites. Then he saw the famous red and blue emblem on her side, the trademark of the mighty industrial clan of Prestine. Prestine of Terra, powerful, munificent, beneficent. And he knew this was a sister ship, for the Nomad was also Prestine-owned. He knew this was an angel from space hovering over him.
Sweet sister, Foyle crooned. Baby angel, fly away home with me.
The ship came abreast of Foyle, illuminated ports along its side glowing with friendly light, its name and registry number clearly visible in illuminated figures on the hull, Vorga-T:1339. The ship was alongside him in a moment, passing him in a second, disappearing in a third. The sister had spurned him. The angel had abandoned him. Foyle stopped dancing and crooning. He stared in dismay. He leaped to the flare panel and slapped buttons. Distress signals, landing, takeoff, and quarantine flares burst from the hull of the Nomad in a madness of white, red, and green light, pulsing, pleading, and Vorga-T:1339 passed silently and implacably, stern jets flaring again as it accelerated on a sunward course. So, in 5 seconds, he was born, he lived, and he died. After 30 years of existence and 6 months of torture, Gully Foyle, the stereotype common man, was no more. The key turned in the lock of his soul, and the door was opened. What emerged expunged the common man forever.
You pass me by, he said with slow, mounting fury. You leave me rot like a dog. You leave me die, Vorka. Vorka-T:1339. No. I get out of here, me. I follow you, Vorka. I find you, Vorka. I pay you back, me. I rot you. I kill you, Vorka. I kill you, filthy.
The acid of fury ran through him, eating away the brute patience and sluggishness that had made a cipher of Gully Foyle, precipitating a chain of reactions that would make an infernal machine of Gully Foyle. He was dedicated.
Vorka, I kill you, filthy.
He did what the cipher could not do. He rescued himself. For 2 days he combed the wreckage in 5-minute forays and devised a harness for his shoulders. He attached an air tank to the harness and connected the tank to a spacesuit helmet with an improvised hose. He wriggled through space like an ant dragging a log, but he had the freedom of the Nomad for all time, he thought. In the control bridge, he taught himself to use the few navigation instruments that were still unbroken, studying the standard manuals that littered the wrecked navigation room. In the 10 years of his service in space, he had never dreamed of attempting such a thing, despite the rewards of promotion and pay. But now he had Vorga-T:1339 to reward him. He took sights. The Nomad was drifting in space on the ecliptic, 300 million miles from the sun. Before him were spread the constellations Perseus, Andromeda, and Pisces. Hanging almost in the foreground was a dusty orange spot that was Jupiter, distinctly a planetary disk to the naked eye. With any luck, he could make a course for Jupiter and rescue. Jupiter was not, could never be, habitable. Like all the outer planets beyond the asteroid orbit, it was a frozen mass of methane and ammonia. But its four largest satellites swarmed with cities and populations now at war with the inner planets. He would be a war prisoner, but he had to stay alive to settle accounts with Vorga-T:1339. Foyle inspected the engine room of the Nomad. There was high-thrust fuel remaining in the tanks, and one of the four tail jets was still in operative condition. Foyle found the engine room manuals and studied them. He repaired the connection between fuel tanks and the one jet chamber. The tanks were on the sun side of the wreck and warmed above freezing point. The high thrust was still liquid, but it would not flow. In free fall, there was no gravity to draw the fuel down the pipes. Foyle studied a space manual and learned something about theoretical gravity. If he could put the Nomad into a spin, centrifugal force would impart enough gravitation to the ship to draw fuel down into the combustion chamber of the jet. If he could fire the combustion chamber, the unequal thrust of the one jet would impart a spin to the Nomad. But he couldn't fire the jet without first having the spin, and he couldn't get the spin without first firing the jet. He thought his way out of the deadlock. He was inspired by Vorga. Foyle opened the drainage petcock in the combustion chamber of the jet and tortuously filled the chamber with fuel by hand. He had primed the pump. Now, if he ignited the fuel, it would fire long enough to impart the spin and start gravity. Then the flow from the tanks would commence and the rocketing would continue. He tried matches. Matches will not burn in the vacuum of space. He tried flint and steel. Sparks will not glow in the absolute zero of space. He thought of red-hot filaments. He had no electric power of any description aboard the Nomad to make a filament red-hot. He found texts and read. Although he was blacking out frequently and close to complete collapse, he thought and planned. He was inspired to greatness by Vorga. Foyle brought ice from the frozen galley tanks, melted it with his own body heat, and added water to the jet combustion chamber. The fuel and the water were non-miscible. They did not mix. The water floated in a thin layer over the fuel. From the chemical stores, Foyle brought a silvery bit of wire, pure sodium metal. He poked the wire through the open petcock. The sodium ignited when it touched the water and flared with high heat. The heat touched off the high thrust, which burst in a needle flame from the petcock. Foyle closed the petcock with a wrench. The ignition held in the chamber, and the lone aft jet slammed out flame with a soundless vibration that shook the ship. The off-center thrust of the jet twisted the Nomad into a slow spin. The torque imparted a slight gravity. Weight returned. The floating debris that cluttered the hull fell to decks, walls, and ceilings, and the gravity kept the fuel feeding from tanks to combustion chamber. Foyle wasted no time on cheers. He left the engine room and struggled forward in desperate haste for a final, fatal observation from the control bridge. This would tell him whether the Nomad was committed to a wild plunge out into the no-return of deep space, or a course for Jupiter and rescue. The slight gravity made his air tank almost impossible to drag. The sudden forward surge of acceleration shook loose masses of debris which flew backward through the Nomad. As Foyle struggled up the companionway stairs to the control deck, the rubble from the bridge came hurtling back down the corridor and smashed into him. He was caught up in this tumbleweed in space, rolled back the length of the empty corridor, and brought up against the galley bulkhead with an impact that shattered his last hold on consciousness. He lay pinned in the center of half a ton of wreckage, helpless, barely alive, but still raging for vengeance. Who are you? Where are you from? Where are you now? Where are you bound? Chapter 2. Between Mars and Jupiter is spread the broad belt of the asteroids. Of the thousands known and unknown, most unique to the freak century was the Sargasso asteroid, a tiny planet manufactured of natural rock and wreckage salvaged by its inhabitants in the course of 200 years. They were savages, the only savages of the 24th century, descendants of a research team of scientists that had been lost and marooned in the asteroid belt 2 centuries before when their ship had failed. By the time their descendants were rediscovered, they had built up a world and a culture of their own, and preferred to remain in space, salvaging and spoiling and practicing a barbaric travesty of the scientific method they remembered from their forebears. They called themselves the scientific people. The world promptly forgot them. SS Nomad looped through space, neither on a course for Jupiter nor the far stars, but drifting across the asteroid belt in the slow spiral of a dying animalcule. It passed within a mile of the Sargasso asteroid, and it was immediately captured by the scientific people to be incorporated into their little planet. They found Foyle. He awoke once while he was being carried in triumph on a litter through the natural and artificial passages within the scavenger asteroid. They were constructed of meteor metal, stone, and hull plates. Some of the plates still bore names long forgotten in the history of space travel. Indus Queen, Terra. Syrtis Rambler, Mars. Three-Ring Circus, Saturn. The passages led to great halls, storerooms, apartments, and homes, all built of salvaged ships cemented into the asteroid. In rapid succession, Foyle was borne through an ancient Ganymede scow, a La Salle ice borer, a captain's barge, a Callisto heavy cruiser, a 22nd century fuel transport with glass tanks still filled with smoky rocket fuel. 2 centuries of salvage were gathered in this hive. Armories of weapons, libraries of books, museums of costumes, warehouses of machinery, tools, rations, drink, chemicals, synthetics, and surrogates. A crowd around the litter was howling triumphantly. "Quant suff!" they shouted. A woman's chorus began an excited bleating. "Ammonium bromide, grams 1.5. Potassium bromide, grams 3. Sodium bromide, grams 2. Citric acid, quant suff." "Quant suff!" the scientific people roared. "Quant suff!" Foyle fainted. He awoke again. He had been taken out of his spacesuit. He was in the greenhouse of the asteroid where plants were grown for fresh oxygen. The 100-yard hull of an old ore carrier formed the room, and one wall had been entirely fitted with salvaged windows. Round ports, square ports, diamond, hexagonal, every shape and age of port had been introduced, until the vast wall was a crazy quilt of glass and light. The distant sun blazed through. The air was hot and moist. Foyle gazed around dimly. A devil face peered at him. Cheeks, chin, nose, and eyelids were hideously tattooed like an ancient Maori mask. Across the brow was tattooed Joseph. The O in Joseph had a tiny arrow thrust up from the right shoulder, turning it into the symbol of Mars, used by scientists to designate male sex. "We are the scientific race," Joseph said. "I am Joseph. These are my people." He gestured. Foyle gazed at the grinning crowd surrounding his litter. All faces were tattooed into devil masks. All brows had names blazoned across them. "How long did you drift?" Joseph asked.
"Vorga," Foyle mumbled.
"You are the first to arrive alive in 50 years. You are a puissant man. Very. Arrival of the fittest is the doctrine of Holy Darwin, most scientific."
"Quant suff!" the crowd bellowed.
Joseph seized Foyle's elbow in the manner of a physician taking a pulse. His devil mouth counted solemnly up to 98.
"Your pulse, 98.6, Joseph said, producing a thermometer and shaking it reverently. "Most scientific."
"Quant suff,"
came the chorus. Joseph proffered an Erlenmeyer flask. It was labeled Lung, Cat, CS, Hematoxylin, and Eosin.
"Vitamin?"
Joseph inquired. When Foyle did not respond, Joseph removed a large pill from the flask, placed it in the bowl of a pipe, and lit it. He puffed once and then gestured. 3 girls appeared before Foyle. Their faces were hideously tattooed. Across each brow was a name, Joan and Moira and Polly, The O of each name had a tiny cross at the base.
Choose, Joseph said. The scientific people practice natural selection. Be scientific in your choice. Be genetic.
As Foyle fainted again, his arm slid off the litter and glanced against Moira.
Quant Sof!
He was in a circular hall with a domed roof. The hall was filled with rusting antique apparatus. A centrifuge, an operating table, a wrecked fluoroscope, autoclaves, cases of corroded surgical instruments. They strapped Foyle down on the operating table while he raved and rambled. They fed him. They shaved and bathed him. Two men began turning the ancient centrifuge by hand. It emitted a rhythmic clanking like the pounding of a war drum. Those assembled began tramping and chanting. They turned on the ancient autoclave. It boiled and geysered, filling the hall with howling steam. They turned on the old fluoroscope. It was short-circuited and spat sizzling bolts of lightning across the steaming hall. A 10-foot figure loomed up to the table. It was Joseph on stilts. He wore a surgical cap, a surgical mask, and a surgeon's gown that hung from his shoulders to the floor. The gown was heavily embroidered with red and black thread, illustrating anatomical sections of the body. Joseph was a lurid tapestry out of a surgical text.
I pronounce you nomad, Joseph intoned.
The uproar became deafening. Joseph tilted a rusty can over Foyle's body. There was the reek of ether. Foyle lost his tatters of consciousness, and darkness enveloped him. Out of the darkness, Vorga-T:1339 surged again and again, accelerating on a sunward course that burst through Foyle's blood and brains until he could not stop screaming silently for vengeance. He was dimly aware of washings and feedings and trampings and chantings. At last he awoke to a lucid interval. There was silence. He was in a bed. The girl, Moira, was in bed with him.
Who you? Foyle croaked.
Your wife, Nomad.
What?
Your wife. You chose me, Nomad. We are gametes.
What?
Scientifically mated,
Moira said proudly. She pulled up the sleeve of her nightgown and showed him her arm. It was disfigured by four ugly slashes.
I have been inoculated with something old, something new, something borrowed, and something blue.
Foyle struggled out of the bed.
Where are we now?
In our home.
What home?
Yours. You are one of us, Nomad. You must marry every month and beget many children. That will be scientific. But I am the first.
Foyle ignored her and explored. He was in the main cabin of a small rocket launch of the early 2300s, once a private yacht. The main cabin had been converted into a bedroom. He lurched to the ports and looked out. The launch was sealed into the mass of the asteroid, connected by passages to the main body. He went aft. Two smaller cabins were filled with growing plants for oxygen. The engine room had been converted into a kitchen. There was high thrust in the fuel tanks, but it fed the burners of a small stove atop the rocket chambers. Foyle went forward. The control cabin was now a parlor, but the controls were still operative. He thought. He went aft to the kitchen and dismantled the stove. He reconnected the fuel tanks to the original jet combustion chambers. Moira followed him curiously.
What are you doing, Nomad?
Got to get out of here, girl, Foyle mumbled. Got business with a ship called Vorga. You dig me, girl? Going to ram out in this boat is all.
Moira backed away in alarm. Foyle saw the look in her eyes and leaped for her. He was so crippled that she avoided him easily. She opened her mouth and let out a piercing scream. At that moment, a mighty clangor filled the launch. It was Joseph and his devil-faced scientific people outside, banging on the metal hull, going through the ritual of a scientific chivalry for the newlyweds. Moira screamed and dodged while Foyle pursued her patiently. He trapped her in a corner, ripped her nightgown off, and bound and gagged her with it. Moira made enough noise to split the asteroid open, but the scientific chivalry was louder. Foyle finished his rough patching of the engine room. He was almost an expert by now. He picked up the writhing girl and took her to the main hatch.
"Leaving," he shouted in Moira's ear. "Take off. Blast right out of asteroid. Hell of a smash, girl. Maybe you all die, you. Everything busted wide open. Guesses for grabs what happens. No more air, no more asteroid. Go tell 'em. Warn 'em. Go, girl."
He opened the hatch, shoved Moira out, slammed the hatch and dogged it. The chivalry stopped abruptly. At the controls, Foyle pressed ignition. The automatic takeoff siren began a howl that had not sounded in decades. The jet chambers ignited with dull concussions. Foyle waited for the temperature to reach firing heat. While he waited, he suffered. The launch was cemented into the asteroid. It was surrounded by stone and iron. Its rear jets were flush on the hull of another ship, packed into the mass. He didn't know what would happen when his jets began their thrust, but he was driven to gamble by Vorga. He fired the jets. There was a hollow explosion as high thrust flamed out of the stern of the ship. The launch shuddered, yawed, heated. A squeal of metal began. Then the launch grated forward. Metal, stone, and glass split asunder, and the ship burst out of the asteroid into space. The inner planet's navy picked him up 90,000 miles outside Mars's orbit. After 7 months of shooting war, the IP patrols were alert but reckless. When the launch failed to answer and give recognition countersigns, it should have been shattered with a blast and questions could have been asked of the wreckage later. But the launch was small and the cruiser crew was hot for prize money. They closed and grappled. They found Foyle inside, crawling like a headless worm through a junk heap of spaceship and home furnishings. He was bleeding again, ripe with stinking gangrene, and one side of his head was pulpy. They brought him into the sick bay aboard the cruiser and carefully curtained his tank. Foyle was no sight even for the tough stomachs of lower-deck Navy men. They patched his carcass in the amniotic tank while they completed their tour of duty. On the jet back to Terra, Foyle recovered consciousness and bubbled words beginning with V. He knew he was saved. He knew that only time stood between him and vengeance. The sickbay orderly heard him exulting in his tank and parted the curtains. Foyle's filmed eyes looked up. The orderly could not restrain his curiosity.
"You hear me, man?" he whispered.
Foyle grunted. The orderly bent lower.
"What happened? Who in hell done that to you?"
"What?" Foyle croaked.
"Don't you know?"
"What? What's the matter, you?"
"Wait a minute is all."
The orderly disappeared as he jaunted to a supply cabin, and reappeared alongside the tank 5 seconds later. Foyle struggled up out of the fluid. His eyes blazed.
"It's coming back, man. Some of it. Jaunt. I couldn't jaunt on the Nomad, me."
"What?"
"I was off my head."
"Man, you didn't have no head left, you."
"I couldn't jaunt. I forgot how's all. I forgot everything, me. Still don't remember much."
He recoiled in terror as the orderly thrust the picture of a hideous, tattooed face before him. It was a Maori mask. Cheeks, chin, nose, and eyelids were decorated with stripes and swirls. Across the brow was blazoned Nomad. Foyle stared, then cried out in agony. The picture was a mirror. The face was his own. Chapter 3. "Bravo, Mr. Harris. Well done. LES, gentlemen. Never forget. Location, elevation, situation. That's the only way to remember your jaunt coordinates. Être entre le moteur et l'enclume. French. Don't jaunt yet, Mr. Peters. Wait your turn. Be patient. You'll all be C-class by and by. Has anyone seen Mr. Foyle? He's missing."
Oh, look at that heavenly brown thrasher. Listen to him. Oh, dear, I'm thinking all over the place. Or have I been speaking, gentlemen?
Half and half, ma'am.
It does seem unfair. One way telepathy is a nuisance. I do apologize for shrapneling you with my thoughts.
We like it, ma'am. You think pretty.
How sweet of you, Mr. Gorgas. All right, class. All back to school, and we start again. Has Mr. Foyle jaunted already? I never can keep track of him.
Robin Winsbury was conducting her re-education class in jaunting on its tour through New York City, and it was as exciting a business for the cerebral cases as it was for the children in her primer class. She treated the adults like children, and they rather enjoyed it. For the past month, they had been memorizing jaunt stages at street intersections, chanting, L-E-S, ma'am, location, elevation, situation. She was a tall, lovely Negro girl, brilliant and cultivated, but handicapped by the fact that she was a telesend, a one-way telepath. She could broadcast her thoughts to the world, but could receive nothing. This was a disadvantage that barred her from more glamorous careers, yet suited her for teaching. Despite her volatile temperament, Robin Winsbury was a thorough and methodical jaunt instructor. The men were brought down from General War Hospital to the jaunt school, which occupied an entire building in the Hudson Bridge at 42nd Street. They started from the school and marched in a sedate crocodile to the vast Times Square jaunt stage, which they earnestly memorized. Then they all jaunted to the school and back to Times Square. The crocodile reformed, and they marched up to Columbus Circle and memorized its coordinates. Then all jaunted back to school via Times Square and returned by the same route to Columbus Circle. Once more, the crocodile formed, and off they went to Grand Army Plaza to repeat the memorizing and the jaunting. Robin was re-educating the patients, all head injuries who had lost the power to jaunt, to the express stops, so to speak, of the public jaunt stages. Later, they would memorize the local stops at street intersections. As their horizons expanded and their powers returned, they would memorize jaunt stages in widening circles, limited as much by income as ability. For one thing was certain, you had to actually see a place to memorize it, which meant you first had to pay for the transportation to get you there. Even 3D photographs would not do the trick. The grand tour had taken on a new significance for the rich.
Location, elevation, situation,
Robin Winsbury lectured, and the class jaunted by express stages from Washington Heights to the Hudson Bridge and back again in primer jumps of a quarter mile each, following their lovely Negro teacher earnestly. The little technical sergeant with the platinum skull suddenly spoke in the gutter tongue.
But there ain't no elevation, ma'am. We're on the ground, us.
Isn't, Sergeant Logan, isn't any would be better.
I beg your pardon. Teaching becomes a habit, and I'm having trouble controlling my thinking today. The war news is so bad. We'll get to elevation when we start memorizing the stages on top of skyscrapers, Sergeant Logan.
The man with the rebuilt skull digested that, then asked,
We hear you when you think, is a matter you?
Exactly.
But you don't hear us.
Never. I'm a one-way telepath.
We all hear you, or just I is all?
That depends, Sergeant Logan. When I'm concentrating, just the one I'm thinking at. When I'm at loose ends, anybody and everybody. Poor souls, excuse me.
Robin turned and called.
Don't hesitate before jaunting, Chief Harris. That starts doubting, and doubting ends jaunting. Just step up and bang off.
I worry sometimes, ma'am.
A chief petty officer with a tightly bandaged head answered. He was obviously stalling at the edge of the jaunt stage.
Worry? About what?
Maybe there's going to be somebody standing where I arrive. Then there'll be a hell of a real bang, man. Excuse me.
Now, I've explained that 100 times. Experts have gauged every jaunt stage in the world to accommodate peak traffic. That's why private jaunt stages are small and the Times Square stage is 200 yards wide. It's all been worked out mathematically, and there isn't one chance in 10 million of a simultaneous arrival. That's less than your chance of being killed in a jet accident.
The bandaged CPO nodded dubiously and stepped up on the raised stage. It was of white concrete, round and decorated on its face with vivid black and white patterns as an aid to memory. In the center was an illuminated plaque which gave its name and jaunt coordinates of latitude, longitude, and elevation. At the moment when the bandaged man was gathering courage for his primer jaunt, the stage began to flicker with a sudden flurry of arrivals and departures. Figures appeared momentarily as they jaunted in, hesitated while they checked their surroundings and set new coordinates, and then disappeared as they jaunted off. At each disappearance, there was a faint pop as displaced air rushed into the space formerly occupied by a body. "Wait, class," Robin called. "There's a rush on. Everybody off the stage, please." Laborers in heavy work clothes, still spattered with snow, were on their way south to their homes after a shift in the North Woods. 50 white-clad dairy clerks were headed west toward St. Louis. They followed the morning from the Eastern time zone to the Pacific zone. And from eastern Greenland, where it was already noon, a horde of white-collar office workers was pouring into New York for their lunch hour. The rush was over in a few moments. "All right, class," Robin called. "We'll continue."
"Oh, dear, where is Mr. Foyle? He always seems to be missing."
"With a face like he's got him, you can't blame him for hiding it, ma'am. Up in the cerebral ward, we call him Boogie."
"He does look dreadful, doesn't he, Sergeant Logan? Can't they get those marks off?"
"They're trying, Miss Robin, but they don't know how yet. It's called tattooing, and it's sort of forgotten is all."
"Then how did Mr. Foyle acquire his face?"
"Nobody knows, Miss Robin. He's up in cerebral because he's lost his mind then. Can't remember nothing. Me, personal, if I had a face like that, I wouldn't want to remember nothing, too."
"It's a pity. He looks frightful. Sergeant Logan, do you suppose I've let a thought about Mr. Foyle slip and hurt his feelings?"
The little man with the platinum skull considered.
"No, ma'am. You wouldn't hurt nobody's feelings, you. And Foyle ain't got none to hurt him. He's just a big dumb ox, is all."
"I have to be so careful, Sergeant Logan. You see, no one likes to know what another person really thinks about him. We imagine that we do, but we don't. This telescending of mine makes me loathed and lonesome. Please don't listen to me. I'm having trouble controlling my thinking." "Ah, there you are, Mr. Foyle. Where in the world have you been wandering?"
Foyle had jaunted in on the stage and stepped off quietly, his hideous face averted.
"Been practicing me," he mumbled.
Robin repressed the shudder of revulsion in her and went to him sympathetically. She took his arm.
"You really should be with us more. We're all friends and having a lovely time. Join in."
Foyle refused to meet her glance. As he pulled his arm away from her sullenly, Robin suddenly realized that his sleeve was soaking wet. His entire hospital uniform was drenched.
"Wet? He's been in the rain somewhere. But I've seen the morning weather reports. No rain east of St. Louis. Then he must have jaunted further than that. But he's not supposed to be able. He's supposed to have lost all memory and ability to jaunt. He's malingering."
Foyle leaped at her.
"Shut up, you!"
The savagery of his face was terrifying.
"Then you are malingering."
"How much do you know?"
"That you're a fool. Stop making a scene."
"Did they hear you?"
"I don't know. Let go of me."
Robin turned away from Foyle.
"All right, class. We're finished for the day. All back to school for the hospital bus. You jaunt first, Sergeant Logan. Remember, L-E-S. Location, elevation, situation."
"What do you want?" Foyle growled. "I'll pay off you."
"Be quiet. Stop making a scene. Now don't hesitate, Chief Harris. Step up and jaunt off."
"I want to talk to you."
"Certainly not. Wait your turn, Mr. Peters. Don't be in such a hurry."
"You going to report me in the hospital?"
"Naturally."
"I want to talk to you."
"No."
"They gone now, all. We got time. I'll meet you in your apartment."
"My apartment?"
Robin was genuinely frightened.
"In Green Bay, Wisconsin."
"This is absurd. I've got nothing to discuss with this..."
"You got plenty, Miss Robin. You got a family to discuss.
Foyle grinned at the terror she radiated.
Meet you in your apartment, he repeated.
You can't possibly know where it is,
she faltered.
Just told you, didn't I?
You couldn't possibly jaunt that far. You...
No,
the mask grinned.
You just told me I was that word. You told the truth, you. We got half an hour. Meet you there.
Robin Winsbury's apartment was in a massive building set alone on the shore of Green Bay. The apartment house looked as though a magician had removed it from a city residential area and abandoned it amidst the Wisconsin pines. Buildings like this were a commonplace in the jaunting world. With self-contained heat and light plants, and jaunting to solve the transportation problem, single and multiple dwellings were built in desert, forest, and wilderness. The apartment itself was a four-room flat, heavily insulated to protect neighbors from Robin's telesending. It was crammed with books, music, paintings, and prints, all evidence of the cultured and lonely life of this unfortunate, wrong-way telepath. Robin jaunted into the living room of the apartment a few seconds after Foyle, who was waiting for her with ferocious impatience.
So now you know for sure,
he began without preamble. He seized her arm in a painful grip.
But you ain't gonna tell nobody in the hospital about me, Miss Robin. Nobody.
Let go of me!
Robin lashed him across his face.
Beast! Savage! Don't you dare touch me!
Foyle released her and stepped back. The impact of her revulsion made him turn away angrily to conceal his face.
So you've been malingering. You knew how to jaunt. You've been jaunting all the while you've been pretending to learn in the primer class, taking big jumps around the country, around the world, for all I know.
Yeah. I go from Times Square to Columbus Circle by way of... most anywhere, Miss Robin.
And that's why you're always missing. But why? Why? What are you up to?
An expression of possessed cunning appeared on the hideous face.
I'm holed up in General Hospital, me. It's my base of operations, see? I'm settling something, Miss Robin. I got a debt to pay off me. I had to find out where a certain ship is. Now I got to pay her back. Now I rot you, Vorga. I kill you, Vorga. I kill you, filthy!
He stopped shouting and glared at her in wild triumph. Robin backed away in alarm.
For God's sake, what are you talking about?
Vorga. Vorga-T:1339. Ever hear of her, Miss Robin? I found out where she is from Boness and Urg's ship registry. Boness and Urg are out in San Fran. I went there, me. The time when you was learning us to cross town joint stages. Went out to San Fran, me. Found Vorga, me. She's in Vancouver shipyards. She's owned by Pristine of Pristine. Heard of him, Miss Robin? Pristine's the biggest man on Terra is all. But he won't stop me. I'll kill Vorga, filthy. And you won't stop me neither, Miss Robin.
Foyle thrust his face close to hers.
Because I cover myself, Miss Robin. I cover every weak spot down the line. I got something on everybody who could stop me before I kill Vorga. Including you, Miss Robin.
No.
Yeah. I found out where you live. They know up at the hospital. I come here and looked around. I read your diary, Miss Robin. You got a family on Callisto, mother and two sisters.
For God's sake.
So that makes you alien belligerent. When the war started, you and all the rest was given 1 month to get out of the inner planets and go home. Any which didn't became spies by law.
Foyle opened his hand.
I got you right here, girl. He clenched his hand.
My mother and sisters have been trying to leave Callisto for a year and a half. We belong here, we...
Got you right here, Foyle repeated. You know what they do to spies? They cut information out of them. They cut you apart, Miss Robin. They take you apart, piece by piece.
The Negro girl screamed. Foyle nodded happily and took her shaking shoulders in his hands.
I got you is all, girl. You can't even run from me because all I got to do is tip intelligence and where are you? There ain't nothing nobody can do to stop me. Not the hospital or even Mr. Holy Mighty Pristine of Pristine.
Get out, you filthy, hideous thing. Get out.
You don't like my face, Miss Robin. There ain't nothing you can do about that either.
Suddenly he picked her up and carried her to a deep couch. He threw her down on the couch.
Nothing, he repeated.
Devoted to the principle of conspicuous waste on which all society is based, Pristine of Pristine had fitted his Victorian mansion in Central Park with elevators, house phones, dumb waiters, and all the other labor-saving devices which jaunting had made obsolete. The servants in that giant gingerbread castle walked dutifully from room to room, opening and closing doors and climbing stairs. Pristine of Pristine arose, dressed with the aid of his valet and barber, descended to the morning room with the aid of an elevator, and breakfasted, assisted by a butler, footman, and waitresses. He left the morning room and entered his study. In an age when communication systems were virtually extinct, when it was far easier to jaunt directly to a man's office for a discussion than to telephone or telegraph, Pristine still maintained an antique telephone switchboard with an operator in his study.
"Get me Dagenham," he said.
The operator struggled and at last put a call through to Dagenham Couriers, Incorporated. This was a 100-million-credit organization of bonded jaunters guaranteed to perform any public or confidential service for any principal. Their fee was 1 credit per mile. Dagenham guaranteed to get a courier around the world in 80 minutes. 80 seconds after Pristine's call was put through, a Dagenham courier appeared on the private jaunt stage outside Pristine's home, was identified, and admitted through the jaunt-proof labyrinth behind the entrance. Like every member of the Dagenham staff, he was an M-class jaunter, capable of teleporting 1,000 miles a jump indefinitely and familiar with thousands of jaunt coordinates. He was a senior specialist in chicanery and cajolery, trained to the incisive efficiency and boldness that characterized Dagenham Couriers and reflected the ruthlessness of its founder.
"Pristine,"
he said, wasting no time on protocol.
"I want to hire Dagenham."
"Ready, Pristine."
"Not you. I want Saul Dagenham himself."
"Mr. Dagenham no longer gives personal service for less than 100,000 credits.
"The amount will be 5 times that."
"Fee or percentage?"
"Both. 250,000 fee and 250,000 guaranteed against 10% of the total amount at risk."
"Agreed. The matter?"
"Pyre."
"Spell it, please."
"The name means nothing to you?"
"No."
"Good. It will to Dagenham. Pyre. Capital P. Y-R. Capital E. Pronounced Pyre, as in funeral pyre. Tell Dagenham we've located the pyre. He's engaged to get it. At all costs. Through a man named Foyle. Gulliver Foyle."
The courier produced a tiny silver pearl, a mimo bead, repeated Pristine's instructions into it, and left without another word. Pristine turned to his telephone operator.
"Get me Regis Sheffield," he directed.
10 minutes after the call went through to Regis Sheffield's law office, a young law clerk appeared on Pristine's private jaunt stage, was vetted and admitted through the maze. He was a bright young man with a scrubbed face and the expression of a delighted rabbit.
"Excuse the delay, Pristine," he said. "We got your call in Chicago, and I'm still only a D-class 500-miler. Took me a while getting here."
"Is your chief trying a case in Chicago?"
"Chicago, New York, and Washington. He's been on the jaunt from court to court all morning. We fill in for him when he's in another court."
"I want to retain him."
"Honored, Pristine. But Mr. Sheffield's pretty busy."
"Not too busy for Pyre."
"Sorry, sir, I don't quite..."
"No, you don't, but Sheffield will. Just tell him Pyre, as in funeral pyre, and the amount of his fee."
"Which is?"
"$250,000 retainer, and 250,000 guaranteed against 10% of the total amount at risk."
And what performance is required of Mr. Sheffield?
To prepare every known legal device for kidnapping a man and holding him against the army, the navy, and the police.
Quite. And the men?
Gulliver, Foyle.
The law clerk muttered quick notes into a memo bead, thrust the bead into his ear, listened, nodded, and departed. Pristine left the study and ascended the plush stairs to his daughter's suite to pay his morning respects. In the homes of the wealthy, the rooms of the female members were blind, without windows or doors, open only to the jaunting of intimate members of the family. Thus was morality maintained and chastity defended. But since Olivia Pristine was herself blind to normal sight, she could not jaunt. Consequently, her suite was entered through doors closely guarded by ancient retainers in the Pristine clan livery. Olivia Pristine was a glorious albino. Her hair was white silk, her skin was white satin, her nails, her lips, and her eyes were coral. She was beautiful and blind in a wonderful way, for she could see in the infrared only, from 7,500 angstroms to 1 millimeter wavelengths. She saw heat waves, magnetic fields, radio waves, radar, sonar, and electromagnetic fields. She was holding her grand levee in the drawing room of the suite. She sat in a brocaded wing chair, sipping tea, guarded by her duenna, holding court, chatting with a dozen men and women standing about the room. She looked like an exquisite statue of marble and coral, her blind eyes flashing as she saw and yet did not see. She saw the drawing room as a pulsating flow of heat emanations, ranging from hot highlights to cool shadows. She saw the dazzling magnetic patterns of clocks, phones, lights, and locks. She saw and recognized people by the characteristic heat patterns radiated by their faces and bodies. She saw, around each head, an aura of the faint electromagnetic brain pattern, and sparkling through the heat radiation of each body, the ever-changing tone of muscle and nerve. Pristine did not care for the artists, musicians, and fops Olivia kept about her, but he was pleased to see a scattering of society notables this morning. There was a Sears Roebuck, a Gillette, young Sidney Kodak, who would one day be Kodak of Kodak, a Houbigant, Buick of Buick, and R.H. Macy XVI, head of the powerful Saxe-Gimbel clan. Pristine paid his respects to his daughter and left the house. He set off for his clan headquarters at 99 Wall Street in a coach and four, driven by a coachman assisted by a groom, both wearing the Pristine trademark of red, black, and blue. That black pea on a field of scarlet and cobalt was one of the most ancient and distinguished trademarks in the social register, rivaling the 57 of the Hines clan and the RR of the Rolls-Royce dynasty in antiquity. The head of the Pristine clan was a familiar sight to New York jaunters. Iron gray, handsome, powerful, impeccably dressed and mannered in the old-fashioned style, Pristine of Pristine was the epitome of the socially elect, for he was so exalted in station that he employed coachmen, grooms, hustlers, stable boys, and horses to perform a function for him which ordinary mortals performed by jaunting. As men climbed the social ladder, they displayed their position by their refusal to jaunt. The newly adopted into a great commercial clan rode an expensive bicycle. A rising clansman drove a small sports car. The captain of a sept was transported in a chauffeur-driven antique from the old days, a vintage Bentley or Cadillac, or a towering Lagonda. An heir presumptive in direct line of succession to the clan chieftainship staffed a yacht or a plane. Pristine of Pristine, head of the clan Pristine, owned carriages, cars, yachts, planes, and trains. His position in society was so lofty that he had not jaunted in 40 years. Secretly, he scorned the bustling new rich like the Dagenhams and Sheffields, who still jaunted and were unashamed. Pristine entered the crenellated keep at 99 Wall Street that was Castle Pristine. It was staffed and guarded by his famous jaunt watch, all in clan livery. Pristine walked with the stately gait of a chieftain as they piped him to his office. Indeed, he was grander than a chieftain, as an importunate government official awaiting audience discovered to his dismay.
That unfortunate man leaped forward from the waiting crowd of petitioners as Pristine passed. "Mr. Pristine," he began, "I'm from the Internal Revenue Department. I must see you this morning." Pristine cut him short with an icy stare.
"There are thousands of Pristines," he pronounced. "All are addressed as Mr. But I am Pristine of Pristine, head of House and Sept, first of the family, chieftain of the clan. I am addressed as Pristine, not Mr. Pristine. Pristine!"
He turned and entered his office, where his staff greeted him with a muted chorus. "Good morning, Pristine." Pristine nodded, smiled his basilisk smile, and seated himself behind the enthroned desk, while the jaunt watch skirled their pipes and ruffled their drums. Pristine signaled for the audience to begin. The household equerry stepped forward with a scroll. Pristine disdained memo beads and all mechanical business devices. "Report on Clan Pristine Enterprises," the equerry began. "Common stock, high, 201.5, low, 201.25. Average quotations, New York, Paris, Ceylon, Tokyo." Pristine waved his hand irritably. The equerry retired, to be replaced by Black Rod.
"Another Mr. Presto to be invested, Pristine."
Pristine restrained his impatience and went through the tedious ceremony of swearing in the 497th Mr. Presto in the hierarchy of Pristine Prestos who managed the shops in the Pristine retail division. Until recently, the man had had a face and body of his own. Now, after years of cautious testing and careful indoctrination, he had been elected to join the Prestos. After 6 months of surgery and psycho-conditioning, he was identical with the other 496 Mr. Prestos and to the idealized portrait of Mr. Presto which hung behind Pristine's dais. A kindly, honest man resembling Abraham Lincoln, a man who instantly inspired affection and trust. Around the world, purchasers entered an identical Pristine store and were greeted by an identical manager, Mr. Presto. He was rivaled, but not surpassed, by the Kodak clan's Mr. Quick and Montgomery Ward's Uncle Monty. When the ceremony was completed, Pristine arose abruptly to indicate that the public investiture was ended. The office was cleared of all but the high officials. Pristine paced, obviously repressing his seething impatience. He never swore, but his restraint was more terrifying than profanity.
"Foil," he said in a suffocated voice. "A common sailor. Dirt, dregs, gutter scum. But that man stands between me and..."
"If you please, Pristine," Blackrod interrupted timidly. "It's 11 o'clock Eastern Time, 8 o'clock Pacific Time.
But..."
"If you please, Pristine, may I remind you that there is a launching ceremony at 9 Pacific Time? You are to preside at the Vancouver shipyards."
"Launching?"
"Our new freighter, the Pristine Princess. It will take some time to establish three-dimensional broadcast contact with the shipyard, so we had better..."
"I will attend in person."
"In person?" Blackrod faltered. "But we cannot possibly fly to Vancouver in an hour, Pristine.
I will jaunt,"
Pristine of Pristine snapped. Such was his agitation. His appalled staff made hasty preparations. Messengers jaunted ahead to warn the Pristine offices across the country, and the private jaunt stages were cleared. Pristine was ushered to the stage within his New York office. It was a circular platform in a black-hung room without windows, a masking and concealment necessary to prevent unauthorized persons from discovering and memorizing coordinates. For the same reason, all homes and offices had one-way windows and confusion labyrinths behind their doors. To jaunt, it was necessary, among other things, for a man to know exactly where he was and where he was going, or there was little hope of arriving anywhere alive. It was as impossible to jaunt from an undetermined starting point as it was to arrive at an unknown destination. Like shooting a pistol, one had to know where to aim and which end of the gun to hold. But a glance through a window or door might be enough to enable a man to memorize the LES coordinates of a place. Pristine stepped on the stage, visualized the coordinates of his destination in the Philadelphia office, seeing the picture clearly and the position accurately. He relaxed and energized one concentrated thrust of will and belief toward the target. He jaunted. There was a dizzy moment in which his eyes blurred.
The New York stage faded out of focus. The Philadelphia stage blurred into focus. There was a sensation of falling down and then up. He arrived. Black Rod and others of his staff arrived a respectful moment later. So, in jaunts of 100 and 200 miles each, Pristine crossed the continent and arrived outside the Vancouver shipping yards at exactly 9 o'clock in the morning, Pacific time. He had left New York at 11 a.m. He had gained 2 hours of daylight. This, too, was a commonplace in a jaunting world. The square mile of unfenced concrete, what fence would bar a jaunter, comprising the shipyard, looked like a white table covered with black pennies neatly arranged in concentric circles. But on closer approach, the pennies enlarged into the 100-foot mouths of black pits dug deep into the bowels of the earth. Each circular mouth was rimmed with concrete buildings, offices, check rooms, canteens, changing rooms. These were the takeoff and landing pits, the dry dock and construction pits of the shipyards. Spaceships, like sailing vessels, were never designed to support their own weight unaided against the drag of gravity. Normal Terran gravity would crack the spine of a spaceship like an eggshell. The ships were built in deep pits, standing vertically in a network of catwalks and construction grids, braced and supported by anti-gravity screens. They took off from similar pits, riding the anti-grav beams upward like motes mounting the vertical shaft of a searchlight, until at last they reached the Roche limit and could thrust with their own jets. Landing spacecraft cut drive jets and rode the same beams downward into the pits. As the Pristine entourage entered the Vancouver yards, they could see which of the pits were in use. From some, the noses and hulls of spaceships extruded, raised a quarter way or halfway above ground by the anti-grav screens as workmen in the pits below brought their aft sections to particular operational levels. End of side one. To continue, turn the cassette over.